Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners. Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for the Technology Report and This is America, coming up after As It Is.
Hello, and welcome to As It Is from VOA Learning English. I'm Christopher Cruz. In Washington. Today on the program, we report on the challenges the U.S. Army is facing in finding young Americans who are in good enough physical condition to serve.
The same issues and the way they're impacting America's overall quality of life, competitiveness in a global economy, and other things.
Then we report on a debate within the Army about possibly letting some soldiers who fight wars on computers to be heavier than soldiers who are fighting on the battlefield. As we will hear, not everyone supports such a change. The U.S. Army's recruiting challenges and possible changes to weight standards for the Army's new cyber warriors. Those are our stories today. On As It Is, we're on the radio, on the web, and we come to you on a daily podcast. We are wherever you are. We're the voice of America. The wars in Afghanistan and Iraq have ended, and Congress has ordered the military to reduce troop levels. But the United States Army and other military services must continue to recruit new soldiers, and it is having trouble finding enough people who are qualified. The Army tells VOA, changes in society have decreased the number of young people who are eligible to join. The U.S. Army plans to reduce its size from 508,000 soldiers to 450,000 by the year 2017. Most new soldiers leave the service after their first enlistment period of 3 or 4 years has ended. So the Army must still recruit between 70,000 and 90,000 young Americans every year to reach its target troop level. People who want to join the Army must be in good physical and mental condition. They must be between the ages of 17 and 34. They must have graduated from high school. They must not have used illegal drugs or have a criminal record. And they may have only small tattoos and none on their hands, face, neck, or head. The Department of Defense says 71% of young Americans between the ages of 17 and 24 would not be accepted into one of the nation's military services if they volunteered. The Army believes that number will increase to 80% by 2020, mostly because of the expected rise in obesity levels. The Army says about 28% of people who apply are rejected because they are overweight or have behavior problems. Others are not permitted to join because they have a criminal record or a history of drug abuse. Some are rejected because they are unable to meet the military's academic requirements. One quarter of the high school graduates who take the Army's math and reading test fail it. Major General Alan Bachelet is the commander of the U.S. Army's Recruiting Command. He spoke to the public radio program Here and Now about the Army's recruiting difficulties. He says the main problem is young Americans' poor physical fitness.
The factors that we use to measure and evaluate people to join the Army, increasingly, they're not able to meet those requirements. It's very troubling, and the trends are not in the good direction, especially in regards to fitness. Young people are showing up at our doors increasingly unfit or obese, and it's a real problem.
The U.S. Army reflects the nature of the country's youth, and many young Americans are simply too fat to fight. General Bachelet says he is worried the Army will soon be unable to reach its recruiting goals. He says the country's current social trends may be creating a serious national security problem. You are listening to As It Is on The Voice of America. The U.S. Army needs cyber warriors to defend against attacks on the nation's computer systems. But it is having a hard time finding young Americans who meet all of the requirements for the job. Cyber warrior candidates must have advanced computer skills, want to join the service, and meet the Army's current physical fitness standards. So the Army is studying whether it should have different height and weight standards for soldiers depending on what job they will do. The possible change could permit cyber warriors, soldiers who fight the enemy in cyberspace, to have more body fat than soldiers who fight on the battlefield. Now, all soldiers must meet the same physical standards, whether they are cooks, clerks, or infantrymen. To remain in the Army, male soldiers between the ages of 17 and 21 must be able to do 35 push-ups and 47 sit-ups. They must also run 2 miles in fewer than 17 minutes. Female soldiers of the same age must reach similar timed targets for push-ups, sit-ups, and a 2-mile run. Major General Alan Bachelet leads the U.S. Army Recruiting Command. The Florida Times Union newspaper reported his comments about possible changes to the Army's standards for some new soldiers. The newspaper said General Bachelet believes people who are fighting a war in cyberspace may not need to meet the same physical standards as infantrymen. They must still be physically fit, healthy, and have a professional appearance, however. But many young Americans are obese and do not exercise much. Many of them are likely to struggle or fail to pass the Army's physical fitness test without training. General Bachelet did not say how the test might be changed to permit those who cannot pass it, but who have the computer skills the Army needs, to join the military. Beth Ash is a senior economist at the RAND Corporation, a research group. She studies military recruiting activities. She told VOA that new missions have always forced the Army to study different recruiting methods.
A few years ago, this issue came up in the context of language capability, that people who had language capability wouldn't necessarily meet other requirements. And the issue there was that people who have language capabilities in the languages we really needed weren't necessarily U.S. citizens or would have passed security clearance-related issues. So these are smaller scale programs that were very targeted to a specific need. And the idea was these people would help meet that need.
The Army told VOA that officials have only talked about possible policy changes. They have not made a decision about changing standards for possible new cyber warriors. A spokesman said, "The Army works in deliberate, careful ways on issues like this, so we don't believe a change will be made soon." That's our program for today. We'll be back tomorrow at this same time with another broadcast, webcast, and podcast edition of As It Is from the Voice of America.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Technology Report. Experts say that sun and wind are the richest sources of clean, renewable energy. But ocean waves also create powerful, clean energy. So, the U.S. Department of Energy has announced a $1.5 million prize for the winner of a competition on how to capture that energy. The Department of Energy says that waves and tides along U.S. coasts create about 1,420 terawatt hours of energy a year. That is equal to the amount of energy produced by more than 330 nuclear power factories. But today's technologies can only capture about 20% of the energy from ocean waves. Jose Zayas is the director of the Wind and Water Power Technologies Office at the Department of Energy. He says 20% is too low for an investment in ocean wave energy to be economical. He says it needs to be up in the high 30% to 40%.
We believe that once you achieve that, then the economic competitiveness of this industry really comes to life. And that's really the target that we're shooting for.
The Department of Energy has launched the Wave Energy Prize competition to encourage development of new technologies. But developing new devices to capture wave energy can be difficult. Wave capture machines must operate in oceans. Competition organizers expect most of the new ideas to come from established energy companies as well as some universities and research centers. Mr. Zayas says testing the new technologies will be done in several steps using scaled models. A scaled model is a smaller form of a larger object or structure.
We would have a 1/50th scale testing where we will do the first fundamental evaluation of their performance as well as making sure that they are on a pathway that can assure them success towards a prize. And near the end, we will have about 10 teams. That is our hope.
The scaled models will be tested at the United States Navy's large indoor testing pool near Washington. Machines at the pool can create ocean-size waves. Mr. Zayas says the models will be tested to show how much ocean wave energy they can capture. The competition will not require the machines to produce electrical power. He says changing the mechanical kinetic energy into electrical energy is easy. Mr. Zayas says the main goal of the Wave Energy Prize is to develop a new set of power-producing technologies for the future. Developers of the best-performing devices will receive prizes from $250,000 to as much as $1.5 million. And that's the VOA Learning English Technology Report. For more technology stories, visit our website, learningenglish.voanews.com. I'm Jonathan Evans.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. The Second World War ended with the surrender of Japan in August 1945. Americans looked to their new president, Harry Truman, to lead them into a new time of peace. Truman was vice president until President Franklin Roosevelt died suddenly in the closing months of the war. Almost no one expected President Truman to be as strong a leader as Roosevelt had been. And at first, they were right. Truman had one problem after another during his first months in the White House. Truman's first big problem was the economy. Almost 2 million Americans lost their jobs as factories ended wartime production. Americans everywhere worried about what would happen next. Only a few years before, the nation had suffered through the worst economic crisis in its history. No one wanted to return to the closed banks, hungry children, and other sad memories of the Great Depression. In some ways, the economy did better after the war than many experts had predicted. Many Americans still had money they had saved during the war, and Congress passed a law designed to help people keep their jobs. The situation could have been much worse than it was. However, the economy could also have been better, much better. Almost overnight, the price of almost everything began to rise. President Truman tried to stop the increases through a special price control agency that had been created during the war. However, thousands of business people refused to follow the government price control rules. Instead, they set their own prices for goods. Store owners would tell government officials that they were obeying the price controls, but often they charged whatever they wanted for the goods they sold. Businesses were not the only ones who were refusing to obey government price controls. Organized labor did the same thing. President Truman had always been a friend of labor unions, but during the first months of his administration, he became involved in a fierce struggle with coal miners and railroad workers. The first sign of trouble came in September 1945. A group of auto workers closed down factories at the Ford Motor Company. Then, workers at General Motors went on strike. Soon, there were strikes everywhere. The oil industry, the clothing industry, the electrical industry, and more. The strikes made Truman angry. He believed the striking workers were threatening the economy and security of the United States. He became even angrier when union representatives came to the White House and refused to accept a compromise wage offer. Truman ordered the army to take over the railroads and the coal mines. Within a short time, the striking coal miners returned to work. However, the president had less success with the railroad workers. He became so angry with the unions representing them that he asked Congress to give him the power to draft all striking railroad workers into the armed forces. The rail strike finally ended, but millions of Americans lost faith in Truman's ability to lead the country and to bring people together. By late 1946, most Americans believed that the man in the White House did not know what he was doing Truman seemed weak and unable to control events. Union members disliked him because of his strong opposition to the coal and rail strikes. Farmers opposed Truman because of the administration's effort to keep meat prices low. Conservatives did not trust the reforms that Truman promised in his speeches, and liberal Democrats watched with concern as many of Franklin Roosevelt's old advisors left the government because they could not work with Truman. In November of 1946, the people voted in congressional and state elections. The results showed they were not satisfied with Truman and his Democratic Party. Republicans won control of both houses of Congress for the first time in 18 years, and Republicans were elected governor in 25 states. The election was a serious defeat for the Democrats, but a disaster for Truman. Some members of his party even called on him to resign. Few people gave Truman much chance of winning the next presidential election in 1948. However, Harry Truman began to change in the months that followed the 1946 congressional elections. He became a stronger speaker. He showed more understanding of the powers of the presidency. And in matters of foreign policy, he began to act more presidential. This was especially so in Truman's reaction to Soviet aggression in Germany. Truman wanted to rebuild Germany, as well as the other war-torn countries of Western Europe. As we heard last week, his administration worked closely with Western European leaders to rescue their broken economies through the Marshall Plan. But the Soviets did not want to see Germany rebuild, at least not so quickly. At first, they flooded Germany with extra German currency in an effort to destroy its value. They walked out of economic conferences. And finally, in early 1948, they blocked all the roads to West Berlin. West Berlin was in communist East Germany, but not under communist control, as was East Berlin. After the war, the Allies had divided Germany in half. West Germany had a democratic government. East Germany was communist, under Soviet control. The Soviet actions in Berlin were a direct threat to the West. Truman had three difficult choices. If he did nothing, the world would think the United States was weak and unable to stop Soviet aggression. If he fought the blockade with force, he might start a Third World War. But there was another choice. The Allies proposed the idea of flying tons of food, fuel, and other supplies into West Berlin. Not just once, but every day, as long as the Russians continued their blockade. It would be a difficult job. West Berlin was home to 2.5 million people. No one had ever tried to supply so large a city by air. Planes would have to take off every 3.5 minutes, day and night, to supply the people with enough food, medicine, clothing, and badly needed coal. The operation involved American C-47 and larger C-54 transport planes, along with British Lancaster, York, and Hastings aircraft. On June 26th, the first C-47s landed at Tempelhof Airport, the beginning of the great operation that was to come. Plans called for the operation to last just a few weeks. The planes landed in the blockaded city, and local volunteers provided support on the ground. Former mechanics of the Luftwaffe, the German Air Force, joined Americans in servicing the aircraft. More than 20,000 Berliners worked day and night to build an additional landing field for the American and British planes. It became Tegel, now Berlin's major airport. As part of the supply effort, the British Royal Air Force even landed Sunderland flying boats on a Berlin lake. Brigadier General Joseph Smith was appointed task force commander of the American part of the airlift. General Smith called the mission Operation Vittles, using an American slang term for food. Operation Vittles also led to Operation Little Vittles, or the dropping of chocolates and other treats to children. The pilots who did this became known as candy bombers. Appreciative German children called them die Schokoladenflieger, the chocolate pilots.
They wanted to know which airplane I was in. I said, you tell my airplane on regular wings, and then you'd know that's me. Watch just that airplane. And they says, good, that's Wunderbar. I came back the next day, and I put little parachutes for the Kalgoorlie and the Schokoladen so they could see it. And so it would hit them hard in the head, slow it down. And so I wiggled the wings, and boy, they waved their hands, and I pushed it out of the airplane. And that's how it started.
It was the idea of Gail Halverson, a pilot in the United States Air Force. Lieutenant Halverson became known as Mr. Wiggly Wings. From his plane, he would drop chewing gum and chocolates attached to tiny parachutes made from handkerchiefs. Soon, many of the airlift pilots were dropping candy from their planes, including into Soviet-controlled areas that they flew over. Americans back home supplied the handkerchiefs, and the chocolate industry supplied the treats. Years later, in Berlin, Gail Halverson told German interviewer Rolf Gründer how he got the idea.
I dropped chocolate because of gratitude. I met 30 children at the fence at Tempelhof, and not one put out their hand and says, give me more than flour, give me more than coal, give me chocolate. And they had no chocolate, they had no gum, but they would not be a beggar. They're so grateful for flour. And I said, wow, they were thankful. And when people are thankful, good things happen.
It soon became clear to the Soviets that the Berlin airlift would succeed. In May of 1949, almost 1 year after they had started their blockade, they ended it. The crisis in Berlin changed the way many Americans saw their president. Harry Truman no longer seemed so weak or unsure of himself. Instead, he was acting as a leader who could take an active part in world affairs. Truman's popularity increased. However, most Americans did not expect him to win the election in 1948. Almost everyone believed that the Republican candidate, New York Governor Thomas Dewey, would capture the office. The election campaign that year turned out to be one of the most exciting and surprising in the history of the nation. That will be our story next week. You can find our series online with transcripts, MP3s, podcasts, and pictures at voaspecialenglish.com. And you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at VOA Learning English. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English.